Good morning, folks. Welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. My name is Mike Santo, and I'm this morning's board representative. We have a variety of announcements about church life and activities this morning. I want you to make special note of one of the announcements on the back of your, of your order of service for today. Sharing the Ministry Fair is being held today in the hall. Join us after the service to find out how you can get involved in the life of the church and help us here at Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. There will be folks there to answer your questions, and you do not have to be a member of the church formally to participate. It is a great way to get to know others in the congregation and to feel part of what we're doing here. We hope you will offer your gifts and talents as we work together to share the ministry of this church. Next Sunday, which is November 1st, our high schoolers will be participating in Interfaith's Make a Difference Day, raking a yard for an elderly disabled gentleman in Oconomowoc. Please dress for the weather and bring a rake. Our 2009 silent auction ended last Sunday, and the winning bidders have been determined. All of the entries were placed on a spreadsheet by Kevin and Amy C., and the total raised is, by the way, $5,201. So we offer a big thank you to all who donated auction items and also to everyone who purchased those items to once again make our silent auction a big success. We came about $275 short of last year's auction results, but considering the state of our economy, let us give ourselves a big hand for coming up with what we did. Of that amount, by the way, the middle schoolers raised $158 and the high schoolers raised $163. The auction committee started distributing the winning tallies this morning as you arrived at church. Please stop by the silent auction table set up in the social hall for those who do not get their results. Thank you. Now is a time when I invite you to greet those sitting around you.
Morning, Scott.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
I bet those are fun events, too.
They are. We have a great congregation here. People volunteer a lot of their time. Yeah. If you are a visitor, we particularly welcome you. Please sign the guest ledger on the visitor's table out in the foyer. There is a variety of information available on that table about our church and about Unitarian Universalism. Help yourself to any that interests you. I will be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions about our church, or if you have been visiting for a while and would like information about becoming a member. I'd be happy to talk with you about that as well. If you are visiting us with your children, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the offertory. At that time, they can go to their religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. And if you would like to go along to observe your child's class, you may do so. The nursery is just out the doors to my right and across the entryway out here. And if there is a need for childcare during the service, you can use the nursery. If there are any visitors who are comfortable introducing themselves, now would be a good time so we can warmly welcome you. Any visitors? Welcome. 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 Thank you for introducing yourselves. That's great. Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. The conversation corner is a good place to gather for further discussion of this morning's service, which I know will be of interest to all of us. Please put your cell phones on silence mode now. That would be a good time. I hope you find this morning's service inspiring, stimulating, and fulfilling. Scott Pritzker is with us today as minister, or as the preacher today. He's currently working on his doctorate at the University of Wisconsin on the relationship between science and religion. He's a former minister in Madison, and he's also been a minister in the state of Michigan. And I guess I'll turn this over to Scott now.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's great to see you again. It's always great to be back in Heartland, get to spend the morning with you. Our opening words this morning are from the African-American theologian Howard Thurman, my favorite theologian, who writes, "In the quietness of this place, surrounded by the all-pervading presence of the holy, my heart whispers, keep fresh before me the moments of my high resolve, that in good times or in tempests, I may not forget that to which my life is committed. Keep fresh before me the moments of my high resolve." And now Mike is going to help lead us in the chalice lighting. Have any young people that would like to come up and get the best seat in the house for the story, this is a great time that we set aside especially for you. It's been a while since I've been here. I don't know if you remember my friend. This is Fudgy Bear. And Fudgy Bear lives in the forest with Mama Bear and Papa Bear and his brother and sister, Arabica and Espresso. So you know where my mind is on Sunday morning. And Grandpa Bear. So it's a big family, and they all live together. Well, you know, summer is now completely, totally over, right? Because it's cold outside already. Well, Fudgy Bear was on vacation for the summer out in Baraboo, visiting his cousin, Mochaccino. And you know how great summer vacation is, right? You get to do so much fun things. Well, you know how it feels when summer vacation ends? It's a little sad. Well, Fudgy Bear was feeling a little sad, and Mochaccino was feeling a little sad, too, about their vacation ending, because Fudgy Bear was going to have to come back here to come back home and go back to school. Well, Fudgy Bear and Mochaccino weren't really talking about how sad they felt, but you could kind of tell sometimes, because they'd get mad at each other in strange ways. They were playing ball on the very last day of vacation, and Mochaccino threw the ball, and Fudgy Bear tried to catch it, and he missed, which I do all the time. And then Mochaccino did a bad thing. He called Fudgy Bear a mean name. He called him a stupid pumpkin head. Yeah, serious stuff. Well, Fudgy Bear felt very bad. If you've ever had a friend call you a name, you know that that's not a lot of fun, right? Well, Fudgy Bear came back home, and it just stayed with him. He felt bad all the time about Mochaccino being so mean to him. Well, Mochaccino later called on the phone, and he did what we should do when we do something mean to someone, which is what? Yeah, we should apologize. We should say we're sorry. So Mochaccino called up and said, "I'm sorry, Fudgy Bear, for calling you a mean name." And it's good when people apologize, but you know it doesn't make it go away either. And so Fudgy Bear still felt kind of bad. And so he was brushing his teeth that night, very important, brushing his teeth. And Mama Bear was watching him to make sure he did it right. And she noticed that he was sad, because Mama Bear is very, very wise. And she said, "Fudgy Bear, what's wrong?" He said, "Mochaccino called me a bad name, and he said he was sorry, but I still feel really bad." Mama Bear said, "Fudgy Bear, let me show you something. Now, I want you to imagine this in your minds, and I want you to promise me that you will not go home and try this, or I will be getting phone calls from other people here." Mama Bear picked up the tube of toothpaste. So imagine a tube of toothpaste in your mind. Imagine what it looks like, maybe what color it is, what color the toothpaste is. And she squeezed that tube of toothpaste so that all of it came out at once. And you can even imagine the sound it makes. All over the sinks. Now, do not try that at home, okay? You promised me, remember, you promised me you weren't going to do that. So it's just imagination. She said, "Fudgy Bear, this toothpaste is like your words. Look how easy it is for it to all just come out. Now I want you to try to put this toothpaste back in the tube." Imagine that. Do you think he was able to do that? No, he couldn't do it. She said, "It's really easy for your words to come out, but it's really hard to take them back in. And now you've got all of this mess to clean up, like it is with your words when you're not careful. So what are you going to do next time, Fudgy Bear, when you're mad at someone?" He said, "I'm going to think a little bit before I say anything mean. I think I'm going to try that too." Well, you've been a very good listeners this morning, so thank you. It's good to get to introduce Fudgy Bear to you guys again, and we're going to continue with our service now. I'd like to invite you to rise as you're able and join in singing together our opening hymn, number 21 in your hymn book, "For the Beauty of the Earth."
Praise for the joy of hearing.
Thank you. Would you please be seated? Another way in which we regularly share our grateful praise for this community and all the good work that you do is through our weekly offertory. At this time, the ushers will pass the baskets for the giving toward the good work and growth of this congregation, and all that you're able to give does make a difference and is very much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you for that special music. So once again, we've reached the time in our service where we share our joys and concerns. And if you've got a special joy or a deep concern you'd like to share, please raise your hands, and the ushers will bring a microphone, and I'll light a candle for you. And I'll start by lighting our memorial candle for lives lost in conflict. Comes to mind most recently, I heard on the news this morning, I think a double car bombing in Baghdad, thinking of all those innocent people died for nothing, and so we always hope for better way and resolution of these kinds of things without violence.
My name is Chris, and I'd like wonder if you would light a candle of joy for the lovely dinner that we had at the Fritz's the other night, which was a meet the minister dinner. And I think that was just such a great idea to have those small group dinners.
Good morning. I'm Barbara, and I'd like you to light a candle of concern for my daughter and son-in-law, who still haven't got a permanent job, and it's been since April, and they have three kids.
My name is Tracy Tim. Could you light a candle of joy for our neighbor who's coming home in a couple of days from Iraq? This is the third time he's been sent overseas for a year. So he's missed 3 years of his children's life, and I'm just so excited he's going to be home safely.
My name's Mike Fort. A candle for my father, Jerry Fort, who passed away Wednesday night, 90 years old.
My name is Dave, and I'd like a candle of joy lit, please. I have a brother who, in the words of one of our middle schoolers, you could say is horizontally challenged. And my parents saw him for the first time in a couple months and said he's looking really great. He's taking care of himself much better.
My name is Yvonne. Please light a candle for my friend Sandy Street, who turned 60 recently, and their family is struggling with the health issues of their son.
Name is Al. Deep concern it's not, but a candle of support for us Obers who may be hurting after the Obers Unders soccer game today at 1.
Hi, I'm Anita, and can you light a candle of concern? One of my really good friends is pregnant, and she's 21 and isn't really quite sure what she's doing now with her life and where she's going, so.
Have a concern that you haven't shared, that please feel free to contact her personally.
And with all these joys and concerns in our hearts, I invite you now into a moment of meditation and reflection and prayer, which we will end by singing from our seats hymn number 83. Breathing and relaxing, we sink into our seats. We feel the earth cradle us as it has always been there for us. And the rhythm of our breath sends our consciousness out around us and deep within us. Breathing and relaxing, we hold these joys and concerns for friends in trouble, for friends leaving trouble, for family of all kinds, near and far, whom we care deeply about. For all the events of our lives, which remind us that human existence is joy and sorrow woven fine, we breathe and open now to the silence and the wisdom that lies in silence. Spirit of life and love, whom we know by many names, we pause in the midst of our busy lives to give thanks for all that is our life, for the bright colors and crisp leaves of life going into a quieter and darker period, for the gurgle of new life in our midst, and for these reminders of things rising and falling within us as well. New possibilities, choices that we must turn away from, and all the courage and persistence and clarity that is required for us to bring our best selves to this moment. For all these gifts, for our awareness of these gifts, and for this moment where we might pause as a community and give thanks for all that matters most. This morning we give great thanks. Blessed be and amen. Thank you. That was lovely. Our reading this morning is from the subject of our service today and touches on his ambivalence with celebrity, his own and others. This is paraphrased from the memoirs of Dr. Joseph Priestley. What I have known of myself has tended to lessen both my admiration and my contempt of others. Could we have entered into the mind of Sir Isaac Newton and have traced all the steps by which he produced his great works, we might see nothing very extraordinary in that process. For this reason, our admiration of philosophers and writers is often lessened by a personal knowledge of them. One of the deepest challenges of being a seeker is to be both present in this current moment, open to all that is wonderful and awful happening now, and knowledgeable about our past that has made us who we are and brought us to this day. Having returned not long ago from a visit to Hungary, I've been reflecting on this dilemma, beginning when I was at an international congress there on the history of science and technology. My own work on the history of Darwin's ideas has brought me into contact with the same questions again and again. How much of an organism's being is the permanent stamp of its genetic inheritance? And how much is developed in response to the world around it and to its need to survive? I was in good company as I puzzled through these issues, as 1,300 scholars had gathered there in Budapest to make sense of how we talk about the past and how we draw upon our history to make sense of the present. Each day was too full with lectures and ideas and hurried conversations over coffee, and by the end of the week I was just overwhelmed intellectually. After the conference, several of us from the University of Wisconsin's Department of the History of Science spent the day on Margaret Island, in the middle of the Danube River, which runs through Budapest. The island is about the size of downtown Oconomowoc and is filled with sculptured gardens, cafes, and outdoor activities. Escaping the 100-plus degree weather on a shady plot of grass, we unpacked a picnic lunch and talked over our sandwiches. Moira, the wife of one of my professors, had been wanting to ask me a few questions about Unitarian Universalism, starting with, "So, are you guys Christians? I can't really tell." I explained that the origins of Unitarianism and Universalism were Christian, stretching back to the radical wing of the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, but that liberal religion's willingness to evolve as times changed had turned us into something very different. After opening our doors to non-Christians in the early 20th century and offering a congenial home to humanists and other skeptics, we had arrived at the present day with a mix of theologies, including Christianity. Of course, this kind of inclusiveness made us a little unusual among congregations, since ours would be made up of people with different beliefs rather than people who are all of the same one. Paul, a recent graduate of our program, mused, "But I think that that would make it difficult to describe who you are if your identities are all over the map." I agreed that we do find it challenging to come to an agreement about who we are and who we're not, but that we tend to attract people who appreciate diversity and enjoy working through life's questions in a diverse community, rather than one where everyone is required or expected to come to the same answer. I added that one advantage of our willingness to evolve is that we're generally able to be more responsive to changing circumstances. Unlike more traditional religions, which have trouble addressing modern issues, because their theological and moral foundations are based on ancient cultures, we've not shied away from contemporary issues such as changing gender roles, new understanding about human sexuality, ever-increasing contact with other cultures, and the appearance of new technologies and their challenges. We've practically always been able to respond quickly and meaningfully to new developments because our movement's identity has evolved to respond to these modern needs. I also thought about saying, but didn't, that the downside of this is that Unitarian Universalists sometimes seem to pursue change just for the sake of novelty, and that we forget that we also have a strong and meaningful history as a movement of seekers. Because so many of us have come to this movement as adults and have the experience of it being new to us, we assume that it's new to the world. But Paul was right. We are constantly seeking some way of interpreting all of our diverse paths into a unified meaning, a unified message of a clear identity. Facing new problems with integrity is one of the reasons that I most like to talk about our movement's history. Looking to the past makes available to us now stories of women and men whose lives were lessons in insight, courage, persistence, and compassion. And these historical figures have become part of the spiritual toolbox that I carry with me to help me live according to my values. I had the opportunity to think more about our heroes this summer when the editor of the Unitarian Universalist World, our denomination's magazine, invited me to review a couple of new books about Unitarian minister and scientist Joseph Priestley. Most people remember Priestley as one of the discoverers of oxygen, as well as a number of other gases, but that's actually only a tiny part of his legacy. He had so many interests and skills that we actually have difficulty telling his whole story. If we portray him primarily as a scientist, we easily overlook the importance of his radical religious and political views, which you'll hear in a moment made him briefly, quote, the most hated man in Britain, unquote. If we look at his life through the lens of Unitarian history, we usually filter out his work as one of the fathers of chemistry, a political philosopher, and a historian. Priestley lived in a time when most of these professions and disciplines were still being defined, and it's difficult for us today to force him into our modern categories. Projecting modern expectations onto the past is a way of distorting history that we call presentism. And this narrow sort of interpretation has kept us from appreciating fully the multifaceted and accomplished person that Priestley was. The time of his childhood coincided with a period in which the Church of England was demanding ever greater conformity to its teachings, and those who didn't cooperate could be barred from civil employment or election to office. A variety of Protestant churches refused to conform to these doctrines, and we call them collectively the dissenting movements. Priestley himself grew up in a dissenting family and attended a dissenting academy as a young man, and so he was exposed to many controversial questions and became accustomed to asking difficult questions himself, as I imagine the young people in our religious education programs grew up being able to pose some unusually pointed and challenging questions to their parents. Despite being plagued with a persistent stutter, he pursued a career as a minister, and his further theological studies only deepened his skepticism about the foundations of Christianity, as well as deepening his commitment to applying reason to the questions of faith. The same tenacity and insightfulness that Priestley brought to religious questioning, he also applied to the scientific world. While serving as minister and teacher in the English towns of Nantwich and then Warrington, he conducted experiments, often as demonstrations for the public, and was encouraged by Benjamin Franklin to write a history of electricity. His studies and experimentation led him next to the exploration of gases, which scientists then classified as different kinds of air, as the understanding of a chemical element had not yet developed. It was in this area of research that Priestley is best remembered, but he also committed a fatal error that prevented him from being perhaps the celebrity he deserves to be. One of the greatest puzzles to researchers in his day was why substances are able to burn in some kinds of air but not in others. Priestley's answer was the theory of phlogiston, an invisible substance that he theorized was released when something is burning, and that once the air is filled with this phlogiston, once it's saturated, then the burning has to stop. Although this theory allowed him to explain a variety of different scientific behaviors, such as combustion, rusting, and metabolism, Priestley's commitment to it prevented him from arriving at the modern understanding, which is that oxygen is a separate element that's required for burning to happen. Another chemist, Antoine Lavoisier, was not devoted to this idea of phlogiston, and therefore he was able to understand that Priestley had really been working with oxygen all along. Therefore, it's Lavoisier who realized what it was he was working with and is credited with being the primary discoverer of this important gas. Despite Priestley's lapse on the question of oxygen, he did discover several other gases, including the technique of carbonating water with carbon dioxide, which he shared openly with anyone who was interested and wanted to do it themselves. And so next time you're enjoying a gin and tonic or a non-alcoholic soda, I invite you to raise a glass and think of Joseph Priestley and his cleverness. Throughout his life, Joseph Priestley's dissenting faith continued to be vitally important to him. And he, in fact, considered his career as a minister more important than all of the other accomplishments for which he is famous. He began to publish writings defending the rights of those liberal dissenters, but also of other dissenters, of Calvinists and even Roman Catholics, who were increasingly being considered criminals in England. When his dissenting friend Theophilus Lindsay proposed that they establish a new Christian denomination that would not demand that its members conform to a single belief, Priestley came to his aid and often preached there, also helping him to found new Unitarian chapels throughout Britain. One of the reasons that I find Joseph Priestley so fascinating is his intellectual integrity. The same foundation of reason and natural experience undergirded not only his science and his faith, but also his political vision and his defense of human rights. While philosopher John Locke believed that women and men were all endowed with the natural rights of life, liberty, and property, Locke trusted that the government would safeguard these liberties for us. Priestley, on the other hand, believed that our rights were guaranteed only if we were active participants in their protection, and that this could happen only through the creation of civil liberties, rights not only in theory, but enshrined in the pages of law. Promoting the values of democratic society was a dangerous position at that time, however. This radicalism, as well as his outspoken support of the American and French revolutions, led those in power to see Priestley increasingly as a threat to the standing order. When he compared the transformative power of reason to, quote, laying gunpowder grain by grain under the old building of error and superstition, his opponents felt justified in branding him a potential domestic terrorist. In July 1791, a mob looted and burned Priestley's home and laboratory, the Unitarian chapel where he served, two more Unitarian chapels, a Baptist meeting house, and the homes of more than two dozen congregation members. Joseph and Mary Priestley narrowly escaped with their lives, and continued threats convinced them finally to emigrate to the United States, where they lived out the rest of their lives in relative quiet. Joseph Priestley distinguished himself as an insightful and articulate minister, philosopher, scientist, political theorist, and historian, and so modern scholars are puzzled about how to categorize him. The two books about him that I reviewed approach this problem in very different ways. The more serious of the two, entitled Joseph Priestley, Scientist, Philosopher, and Theologian, handled it by bringing together seven scholars, each one evaluating Priestley from their own area of expertise. And the result of that was a very detailed and what I felt was a very complete portrait of Priestley as a whole person. The more popular book, called The Invention of Error by Stephen Johnson, was an almost textbook example of a presentist distortion of history. The author reasoned that because Priestley's work doesn't look like today's chemistry, theology, philosophy, etc., that we can consider him a sloppy dabbler and an undisciplined experimentalist. Johnson demonstrates in his book that when we expect historical figures to be evaluated by our standards rather than their own standards, we end up with a fundamental misunderstanding about the significance of our past. Both Priestley's inability to let go of a theory that no longer worked well and historians' inability to let go of an assumption about what we'll find when we look at our origins illustrate how fundamentally our assumptions can prevent us from seeing the whole picture. I saw quite a bit of this at that conference in Budapest last summer in the variety of history that we pejoratively call great man history, describing the past as a series of celebrities, intellectual or political giants who stand out fundamentally from the rest of us ordinary folk. When we tell the history of science in this way, it's like jumping along a series of stepping stones. Plato, Galileo, Newton, Einstein, Stephen Hawking, with long stretches of absolutely nothing happening in between. If you studied history in school as just a series of names and dates and places, this is the picture you came away with. In my opinion, inaccurate, and as you know, completely uninteresting. What we've come to realize is that it's not just the celebrities who have completely changed the flow of history. Lesser figures, whose work doesn't resemble our assumptions today, have also made their mark, often in ways that made it possible for those celebrities to shine. I'm fond of asking, it's in the nature of superhuman figures to do amazing things, so where's the wonder in that? Although it's harder to report, history is more accurately understood, and in my opinion much more meaningful, when it's the story of ordinary people finding it in themselves to do extraordinary things. We might also think about this when we consider who we are as a movement and who you are as a congregation. It's easy to think that it's the most visible leaders that make the most difference, but the answer is really much more complicated than that. I'd like to think that what I say from the pulpit matters, but I know that it's really the relatively ordinary encounters between members and between members and visitors that gives this place its identity. For example, a minister or other leader may say here from the lectern that this is a welcoming and open-minded community, but if visitors find that no one greets them at coffee hour, or they receive only an awkward silence when they share what they believe or what they're most passionate about, then the official identity of our congregation is just talk. It's the relationships, it's the quality of connections between each of you that come out in your conversations, that come out in your efforts to reach out to each other and to lean upon each other, that lead people to think of this as an authentic and nurturing place. The message that I find in Priestley's story and our attempt to create meaning from his part in our history is of the importance of greeting the world with our eyes and hearts and minds wide open, that our assumptions about what we'll find won't prevent us from appreciating what's actually there. I hope that you'll be a part of helping to make this community a place of open eyes and minds and hearts, and join me in being grateful this morning also for a history that helps us understand what that kind of integrity means. Now I'd like to invite you to rise as you're able and join in singing together our closing hymn, number 318 in your hymn book, We Would Be One.
Ourselves to greater. service with love and justice strive to make us free.
Thank you. Would you please be seated? And now we come to a special time in our service where we invite further reflection and question and answer on our topic or whatever that topic has stirred in you. This is a reminder that truth and wisdom are never closed and that all of us have a part in creating that tapestry of understanding together. If you'd raise your hand so that our ushers could see you, they'll bring a microphone so everybody could appreciate your contribution. And I'd like to invite you now into our dialogue.
Hi there, my name is Dave, and I appreciate what you were kind of saying about how the dots are connected by the little people. We are the little people, and the little people, we all work together to become the movement, as you said, which kind of leads me to my original thought, which I thought I would bring up here, is you use the word movement a lot to describe Unitarian Universalism. You seem to be avoiding the word religion, and I was curious as to if that was true, and you know, if so, if there was reasoning behind that, or if it was just to sort of emphasize the fact that it's an ongoing, progressing kind of thing that we're all involved in here.
That's a great question. I've never actually had anybody ask me about that, but I do appreciate sort of the dynamic quality of the word movement, although part of the caution of this service is also about that it's not always about looking toward something new. And so, you know, I hope that this is sort of a cautionary tale as well, that we've got deep roots that are worth grabbing onto as well. I think being a visiting preacher, I'm always a little guarded about what language I bring to congregations. I know that the word religion is one that has had more success in some congregations than others. And I think this congregation has shown a maybe greater than average comfort with some of this language. But actually, it wasn't an intentional choice. It's interesting to have that pointed out to me now, because I'm a little self-conscious. But it's a good question, Dave. I'm gonna watch for that and see if that means anything. Some subconscious thing going on there. I see Jerry back there.
Yes, I'm Jerry. Scott, did you say you're working on a book or study of the relationship between science and religion?
Well, I'm that would be a very kind way of putting it. I'm thinking about considering possibly working on a dissertation in the relationship between science and religion. I was told that you in particular have a deep interest in Darwin's ideas, and so I thought I might actually get to have a conversation with you about that. My master's thesis was about the reception of Darwin's ideas in Hungary. I've spoken to this congregation before about my experiences when I spent 2 years teaching English at the Unitarian Seminary in Transylvania and have studied Hungarian for 15 years. So that was my primary research language for my master's paper. And I think that I've become hooked by Darwin's studies, and so my advisor and I are just now starting to sort of give some shape to the possibility of a dissertation topic, because I've just finished the master's and I'm starting the doctorate now. And I think what I'm hoping to do is looking at the relationship between ideologies and Darwin's theories. How did ideologies like democratic theory, socialism, capitalism, and religious thought contribute to Darwin's ideas, and how were they affected by Darwin's ideas? Don't look on the bookshelves anytime soon for that. I'm going to be in the doctoral program for probably 5 more years, so you'll hear about my progress if I make any.
Eric Moraine. Tell me again the name of the substance that Priestley was looking for.
Phlogiston.
Phlogista.
A mouthful. Phlogiston.
Phlogista.
Phlogiston.
Phlogiston.
Yeah.
Got it. Thank you.
It's a strange word.
So, in my reductionist way of thinking, religion is the pursuit of proving phlogiston exists, and spirituality is the continued search for oxygen.
Ooh. Dave, did that answer your question? Whenever you have two Unitarian Universalists together, you have three opinions. It's so awesome. And so when I explain this experience to people who are not UUs, either they're horrified or they're completely enthralled. And my professor's wife was completely enthralled. She would have loved the thought that a congregation could have these different insights with some tension between them and us not be freaked out by that. Excellent. I'm gonna mull over that a bit. That's a very meaty comment, Eric. Thank you. I may have talked with you over coffee.
My name is Alan. I wanted to talk about questions, and actually, though, with Eric's comment, was there some phlogiston in that homebrew of yours last night? At one point, you talked about children in our movement, religion, however
right.
you want to put it.
Right.
And as a parent, both daughters of mine are inquisitive, but one was the why.
Right. Right.
And I'm proud to say that she's still the why. And I think perhaps that... and maybe it's arrogant of me being proud to be a Unitarian Universalist, but mm-hmm. I truly think having worked with kids in our RE program from itty-bitty up till now to the high school level, that the questions don't stop, and they're well thought, and the answer that you give is not accepted just on its face. It's
right.
it's tested and
right.
thought further. And for those that appreciate that kind of dialogue, I'm not saying don't go to our services, but take a moment and spend some time in those RE classrooms. Mm-hmm. It's a very enlightening experience.
Marvelous PR for your RE program. Working with the RE program is one of the best ways to be reminded of how inquisitive you used to be. I mean, it's really to have it sort of right in front of your face. And for me, it makes me remember, gosh, I used to be curious about everything. How did that stop? Why did I stop doing that? And I think that that's one of the things that we can be so powerful an ally to our teens in particular, because adolescence is so much in the larger world a time of sort of frightening our young people into conformity. And I think for a lot of us, we don't ever go back to being inquisitive again. And so helping our teens feel like it's okay to continue being that why kind of person, even though it is going to seem at a lot of times like people are pressuring them to cut off that part of themselves. I think that helping our young people to feel that asking those questions is exactly the right thing to do, and that it is a brave and wise and insightful way of going into the world, is one of the most important things we do for the world. That when my first position when I moved to Madison to work at First Unitarian Society was as campus and young adult minister. And so about half of my work week was spent with 18 through 25-year-olds, and you really saw such a marked difference between the ones who had chosen to sort of shut part of themselves down so that they could get along and not feel constantly challenged by their peers, and then the ones who continued to pose the questions and to sort of stand up and speak their truth. And that was just a, I mean, that is the sort of lesson that I mentioned first of all. It's that it's sort of having it right in front of your face, like, wow, what did I do with my adulthood? In what ways have I chosen to go the path of no resistance and shut part of my heart down in that process? So that's a wonderful insight. Ari is an amazing place to sort of come back in touch with your own core. So I really appreciate your insight in that.
My name's Yvonne, and I can see several hands, so I'm going to keep it short. But I have two points. One is that I was really disappointed in school. And you mentioned the scientists leaping. But also in studying history, it was one war after another. And I think Ken Burns has done our culture a great service by pointing out the personal aspect of many of those happenings. And then the second, as we're burying our parents and welcoming the gurgle of new life, you ask, you know, in writing an obituary, now what is this person about? What has he done? What does he or she think they've done and the lives they've touched? And then you look at this four-month-old and say, is she going to be a singer? A comedian was one. You know, the speculation of what the potential there as well.
That's wonderful. Yeah, the whole span of life is just so amazing to think about.
My name is Rob, and thanks for telling Priestley's story and his contribution in discovering oxygen. As a fifth grade science teacher, I'm always telling my students that even though you don't come up with the right answer, you've helped us out. Because it's not failure that you did something wrong, you've just discovered something new, you ask that question again. And I always use cancer as an example, that there are many, many people working on cancer. And when that cure is found, one person is going to maybe get the credit, but it sure took all those other people and all their work to help them narrow that to whatever that cure is going to be. And I think it's really important for everyone to understand that everyone is contributing to that cure or whatever it might be.
That's such a marvelous insight. One of my favorite, the course that I taught last year was the history of ancient and medieval science. And one of my favorite parts of that semester was teaching about the point at which it became okay to get no as a result. And that was part of the process and it wasn't a failure. It was part of understanding where the path goes and where the path doesn't go. That's wonderful that your fifth graders are already getting that.
Yes, I appreciate the idea of intellectual integrity, especially brought out in a religious or church setting, whatever you want to call it, which reminds me of my own background and coming up from a very right-of-center religious community, and through the course of my spiritual journey being on the very left side of that, and recognizing in that both sides that I've affiliated myself at different points of my life have often not taken the other side seriously. And as I think about that, with regard to the comment on religion and such, as my own view is that science and religion are not incompatible whatsoever. Because they deal with different categories of understanding, one being more factual based and scientifically, proofs and such like that to be the criteria and the standards for judging whether it's good or right or true, and the other being much more what I would call mythopoetic and really more metaphorical and a sense in which it doesn't relate so much to the facts of life, but rather to the truths, to the meanings, to the purpose of life. And I remember a comment by Walter Kaufman with regards to his perception of Jews versus conservative or fundamentalist Christians, and that if somebody says to that Jew, we don't believe in all your God and your theories and your theologies and stuff like that, and they will simply laugh it off and say, but isn't it meaningful? And the fundamentalist, on the other hand, may try to defend in every way. And as a progressive Christian myself, I see that oftentimes I get lumped in with all Christians.
Right.
And that... religion becomes a bad thing. And for me, religion is more about community and a metaphorical, a mythopoetic view of reality that I can have in conjunction with my scientific understanding. And so I'd like to hear your kind of comments on what you see the distinction between religion and science and whether it is anything close to what I've tried to describe.
Right. Well, I'm absolutely with you there. So that part's easy. the harder part now is, I mean, I have to be aware as a theologian and a former scientist that when I say that I think science and religion are compatible, that I'm defining science and religion to be compatible. That I want that as an end product. And so, you know, I'm aware that I'm discounting certain levels of very rigid theology that I just think are not a part of my religious world. And I'm sort of cutting away views that many people in the sciences have about that mythopoetic world that you talk about. This is actually one of the things that I'm struggling with the hardest over in Unitarian Universalism right now, is what is the place of science in our movement? Because we have both a very strong tradition and history and interest in scientific knowledge, but we also have a very strong interest in things that are not summed up scientifically. And so I'm trying to make some sense of that. For me, it's clear that Unitarian Universalism is not completely explained in scientific language, or it's not adequately explained in scientific language. And this, in fact, is part of what led me to wanting to do my doctoral work on ideologies relating to Darwin, is the sense that we are the species that makes meaning. We are the species that looks for ways to fit truths together so that they're compatible. We look for patterns, we look for compatibilities, and that's a great strength. That allows us to have poetry and spirituality and things like all the sciences, and make a meaningful life out of that. The downside is we want to ignore the things that don't fit into that package. And so I have to struggle with exactly what you're saying. What does liberal or progressive ideology fail to acknowledge? What is it deliberately or innocently ignoring in wanting to make everything fit? And for me, that requires that I be able to sit with the discomfort of things not quite always fitting, and I'm very much a work in progress on that. So that's sort of where I stand at the moment. John, were you motioning for the microphone, or you? We had a gentleman down front here. How are we doing on time? Are we okay? Okay. Because if you give a UU a microphone, oh, my Lord, it's just, you know, it's like I don't want to let go of it.
Well, thank you for sharing some of our history, that it's always good to reflect on how we got to where we've come.
Yeah.
And one of the thoughts that went through my mind is, as we've evolved and changed over time, you have to wonder, well, as other religions tend to have these bedrock beliefs, mm-hmm. and ours almost by definition are not, and you just wonder, well, what are we going to look like, you know, 100 years from now or 200 years from now, and what are our real bedrock beliefs? We can look at our principles and kind of say that this is kind of where we are, but just a thought that went through my mind is just wondering, well, if by definition we're always evolving and changing and willing to change and open to change, well, you know, what is there in our faith that's really solid?
Right.
And you'd like to think there are things that are like others.
Yeah.
Just a thought.
Yeah. The great Unitarian historian Earl Morse Wilbur identified those three permanent aspects of our movement as freedom of belief, the use of reason in making meaning in our world, and tolerance for those who have come to different conclusions in their beliefs. He thought those three were the core, and that while their expressions change, the window dressing around them changes, that they are the center, that they are the rock that has been a part of our tradition. Whether that continues to be true, I don't know. I mean, I trust so. I mean, that's what makes this movement the place that I want to call home, are those that heart to the movement. Others? Well, thank you for a wonderful dialogue. I would like to close and extinguish our chalice from the words from my dear, now deceased colleague, Elizabeth Selly Jones, who writes, "We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again."
Thank you.